Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, June 20th, 2019. As I've mentioned, today's my last podcast for the next 3 weeks. I'm taking a long vacation, looking forward to it. I need it. And I will resume podcasting on Monday, July 15th, right here at the same place where you found this podcast. And before I begin, I want to thank Raul Velez. He is the unpaid chief engineer for the Peter B. Collins podcast. And he and I were here until the wee hours of the morning, upgrading the studio. We installed a zippy new digital mixer, and I'm playing with it right now. It's working. You'll notice a little difference in the sound. It's a little richer and warmer, not quite as robotic of the processing we were using before. And I'm just very pleased at the upgrades that Raul has helped guide us through. And he actually listens to this podcast, so that's why I wanted to give him a big shout-out here at the top of the show. And I also want to mention that at 1 a.m. or so when I was driving home, I picked up a network news report that Donald Trump had pulled back at the last minute, planning a strike on certain facilities in Iran. And 10 minutes before the D-Day moment, the decision moment, he called it off. Now, this raises many areas of criticism. First of all, let me begin with a positive. This is the smartest thing Trump has done that I can think of, ever. But it is a different kind of Trump. He went rogue on himself. Because this highly insecure man, who requires the idolation of the mob rallies that he receives, and he regularly rails against what he perceives as the unfairness of media coverage of him as president. And his insecurity allowed him to be played by Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. And in lengthy meetings in the Situation Room on Thursday, they hammered out a plan. Trump signed off on it. And the military was ready to launch when he changed his mind. Now, this is another un-Trumpian move. Donald Trump never admits that he's wrong. He never wants to show even a whiff of not being 1,000% behind whatever bullshit he has just uttered. He has also discovered the concept of proportionality, which I think is new to him. And he expressed unusual concern for non-American lives. So, based on his tweets, and it is so insulting to be tweeted at, he said, well, 10 minutes before the decision time, he spoke to a general who told him that the strike would take out probably 150 Iranians. And he said, well, that was not a proportionate response to the downing of an unmanned American drone over disputed airspace, which occurred early on Thursday. And in the voice of omniscience, the New York Times says it's unclear why Mr. Trump would have been getting information about possible casualties so late in the process of launching military action. In one of his tweets, sanctions are biting, more added last night. We don't have details on that. Iran can, all caps, never have capital N nuclear, capital W weapons, not against the USA, not against the all caps world. And as you know, I'm one of the few people who take seriously the work of Gareth Porter, the journalist and historian, who did deep research on the Iranian nuclear program. And his conclusion is that Iran has used a kind of constructive ambiguity of its intentions as a way to keep the rest of the world off balance, including the U.S. of A. and Israel. And that the Ayatollah has never approved the development of nuclear weapons by the nation of Iran. And so when you hear Trump say, Iran can never have nuclear weapons, he is falling for their ruse. And the other issue is that the U.S. has conceded that it's unclear whether the American drone that was shot down was actually over international waters and therefore not violating Iranian airspace. And one of the curious things in the news coverage I've heard is that Iran says they tried to warn the drone. Well, how do you warn a robot? I mean, you can't buzz it with a fighter jet. There's nobody in the cockpit. And if it's being controlled from the Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas or one of those places in upstate New York where Ann Wright and other protesters have let us know the drone control points are located, I mean, is there an 800 number you can call? Is there a website where you can say, hey, we're going to shoot down your drone if you don't get it out of our territory? So Iran also said that they passed on shooting down a manned American surveillance craft, a P-3 Orion. Now, this is an older generation of surveillance planes. There used to be a whole fleet of them that flew out of the Bay Area, and there were about 35 crew members on that P-3. But Iran said that they weren't interested in shooting down a plane with humans on it. So, what we know is that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, according to unnamed sources who leaked to the New York Times, that Pompeo argued that sanctions were having a powerful effect and he wanted a pinpoint military response to the drone strike. And it appears to be John Bolton, who is just bloodthirsty, and I guess Liz Cheney is his counterpart. And I wrote down the terms in my notes here that Liz Cheney is acting like a bloodthirsty, and I used the B word. And, you know, I don't even call my dog a bitch, okay? But the Cheney family is so despicable and detestable. And Liz has every unfortunate feature of her father and then some. So she went on Hugh Hewitt's radio show to lecture the president without naming him. The failure to respond to this kind of direct provocation that we've seen now from the Iranians could, in fact, be a very serious mistake. But on the other side, Elizabeth Warren, running for president, quote, Donald Trump promised to bring our troops home. Instead, he has pulled out of a deal that was working and instigated another unnecessary conflict. There's no justification for further escalating this crisis. We need to step back from the brink of war. And the Times quotes David Rothkopf, who is the author of two histories of the National Security Council. And he says the fact that Trump blinked in the face of Iran's aggression was not a sign of restraint, so much as evidence of indecision and bumbling. The situation remains very dangerous and prone to accidental escalation or spinning out of control. And I want to underscore that at this point, we got a reprieve. This doesn't mean that Trump is canceling any response. And he may even come up with something worse than what he canceled last night. But for the moment, we'll take it and hope that some sort of sanity will prevail. So we have a situation here with a series of unproven claims. The unproven claims that Iran sabotaged those tankers in the Gulf of Oman last week with the limpet mines. And now the arguable point about where that drone was when it was shot down. And the idea that we could rush to war on this basis, or that we could, you know, launch a pinpoint assault and everything would turn out hunky-dory, well, neither one of those is fathomable to me. I've been reading Roger Cohen for many years in the New York Times, and I don't generally find him very compelling. But I recommend his column today. President Trump has been all over the place on Iran, which is what happens when you take a serious subject Treat it with farcical superficiality? Believe braggadocio will sway a proud and ancient civilization? Approach foreign policy like a real estate deal? Defer to advisors with Iran derangement syndrome? Refuse to read any briefing papers and confuse the American national interest with the Saudi or Israeli? That's a pretty powerful opener. And he continued, quote, "This American slouching toward another Middle East war has been a disgrace. Shot through with the twisting of truth or outright lies. Now Trump has approved only to reverse a retaliatory strike for the Iranian downing of an American drone. An aptly chaotic culmination to the drift the president has allowed. The 11th hour calling off of military action was the one wise decision Trump has taken on Iran since he took office. Dazzled by Saudi blandishments, Israeli veneration, and the opportunity to trash Obama's diplomacy and the lure of evangelical votes, Trump determined from day one that the Islamic Republic was the enemy from central casting. His view was unburdened by any serious assessment of how to balance toughness and engagement in the long traumatized American-Iranian relationship." And I'll quote one more paragraph. "The U.S. does not need the war with Iran that John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and Secretary of State Pompeo seem determined to deliver. It would be a war of choice, illusion, and irresponsibility. It would place Americans at risk across the Middle East with no benefit to the United States or its allies." So I encourage you to read this piece. He actually has a decent quote from former Secretary of State John Kerry, and then this from Steve Bannon, the former chief strategist for the Trump campaign, and he lasted 9 months in the White House. He told Cohen, "I don't think any Trump supporters support further military engagement in the Middle East right now. His default position is not to be an interventionist. I never thought he'd be this far down this path, and I'm not loving the trend line. For the Trump base, war would hurt." I actually don't agree with that, but I think it's interesting to hear Bannon articulate it. "I think the Trump base loves it wrong and strong," as Bill Clinton once said. They don't really care. And they'll tolerate endless war. Because it's, you know, Muslims. Joe Lauria, who is now the editor-in-chief at Consortium News, a longtime international reporter who covered the United Nations for many years. He wrote a great piece instantly after the news broke, opening, "The commander-in-chief acted like one, if only briefly, on Thursday night when he said he called off airstrikes on Iran and potentially a devastating war in the Persian Gulf. It seems unlikely," says Lauria, "that a president would have to ask at the last minute about potential civilian casualties. A more likely scenario is that Trump was in an epic struggle with his most hawkish national security advisors, Pompeo and Bolton, and with himself, and that he could not decide what to do until literally the last 10 minutes and used the excuse of civilian deaths to pull back. He has been sending seriously mixed signals to Iran. On the one hand, he has told Iran he wants to negotiate with them to replace the nuclear deal that he unwisely pulled out of last year. And on the other hand, he's gone as far as threatening what amounts to genocide. If Trump is engaged," this is Lauria continuing, "if Trump is engaged in a good cop, bad cop strategy with Iran, with Pompeo and Bolton playing very convincing bad cops, then Trump is a disastrous good cop. He has been essentially playing good cop, bad cop with himself. We've got three bad cops here. Pompeo, Bolton, and half of Trump. And one good cop, the other half of Trump." He goes on, "If Trump were really committed to the anti-interventionist rhetoric of his campaign, which many of his followers still believe in, he would not have appointed Pompeo and Bolton to begin with, unless under extreme pressure from, say, someone like Sheldon Adelson, the fanatically pro-Israel casino magnate and a major Republican donor." Good piece from Joe Lauria. Check it out. Now, we also are learning that Trump has decided that maybe if he's going to start a war, he ought to have a permanent defense secretary over there at the Pentagon. And so, after leaving Mike Shanahan dangling as acting secretary, only to withdraw this week after his family crisis surfaced, and you know, I don't want to make hay on Shanahan's personal problems. My objections are to his history with Boeing and his complicity in the games of Trump, Bolton, and Pompeo. So now we get a former lobbyist and executive at Raytheon, the defense contractor, a guy who served at the Heritage Foundation. His name is Mark Esper. And as we mentioned the other day, when he got the call for his promotion to replace Shanahan as at least the acting DOD boss, he was shocked. He didn't see it coming. And now Trump is going to make him the permanent defense secretary. He's got friends over on Capitol Hill. Lindsey Graham loves him. So it is likely, with the tensions with Iran, that Congress will, in typical fashion, move quickly to confirm him without any tough questions. Democrats are commenting. Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, candidate for president, said Trump's actions amounted to governing by chaos. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, also running for president, warned that war with Iran was highly likely unless Trump swallows his pride and returns to the Iran nuclear agreement that he tore up. I agree with Tulsi on that. I just think that unless we see more of the un-Trump that I've been describing here in the first few minutes, that's not going to happen. Bernie Sanders called on Congress to assert its constitutional authority and stop Trump from going to war. Well, number 16 has surfaced. A woman with a credible claim that Donald Trump sexually assaulted her. And the woman is fairly well known. E. Jean Carroll is a journalist. She's been writing an advice column for Elle magazine, which I've never seen. And she says that in 95 or 96, Trump recognized her when she was shopping at Bergdorf Goodman. And he walked up to her and said, "Oh, you're that advice lady." He said he was there to buy a gift for a girl, and that Trump suggested a lace bodysuit and urged her to try it on. When they reached the dressing room, she said Trump shoved her against the wall, pulled down her pants and tights, forced his fingers around my private area, thrust his penis halfway or completely, I'm not certain, inside me. And she told two friends about the incident. One said she should go to the police. The other said, forget it. Trump's legal team would bury her. And so she has gone public, immediately denounced by the White House. Not true, never happened. And she anticipated that she'd be asked why she waited so long. She writes, receiving death threats, being driven from my home, being dismissed, dragged through the mud, joining the 15 women who've come forward with credible stories about how the man grabbed, badgered, belittled, mauled, molested, and assaulted them, only to see the man turn it around, deny, threaten, and attack them, never sounded like much fun. Also, she said, I'm a coward. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people who chip in $5 or $10 a month. Carla Mahoney is one of them. There's Ben Brotman. Also, I want to thank Joe Carson, a longtime supporter. And let's see, Andrew Harnack is the gentleman that we just converted from a paid subscription to a scholarship because of his health conditions, and we're happy to do that. So I appreciate all the people who support me. And if you're not currently a subscriber, don't feel guilty. I just do the soft pitch here, and you can get to it when you're ready. Visit peterbcollins.com. Click on Become a Subscriber, then you land on the sign-up page. It's very easy to choose $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. I've still got copies of 2100, A Dystopian Utopia, the blueprint for human survival from climate change, and we'll get to another dire story about that coming up in a moment. But you get a bonus book if you take out a new annual subscription for $50 and give me a mailing address in the continental United States. In San Diego, there's a war crimes trial, a court martial underway, and it's complicated. The main target, the person being tried, is Chief Edward Gallagher of the Navy SEALs. And there was a big shocker in the courtroom yesterday. Testifying under immunity, Special Operator First Class Corey Scott said that Gallagher, who was accused of killing a teenage ISIS fighter who was not armed and he was wounded, well, this guy Scott said, in fact, Gallagher didn't kill him. I did. Now, the story is that Gallagher had stabbed this guy multiple times. And according to the testimony of Scott, I knew he was going to die anyway and wanted to save him from waking up to whatever would have happened to him. And so he says that he pressed his thumb over the captive's breathing tube until he died. Now, this is stunning testimony. The prosecutors are totally pissed. They said in all the pretrial interviews, he never said anything of this sort. And he has been granted immunity, but the immunity only holds if he is found to have told the truth. So it's possible that this is a cover-up. That Operator Scott has decided to separate himself from the SEAL team members who turned in Gallagher in the first place for his extreme behavior. And that's putting it really politely. He's a bloodthirsty monster. And what this shows is that there is little honor among uniformed savages. We've got another case, and this one, Trump is going to demagogue to the hilt. In my view, it's another frame-up by the FBI of a so-called domestic terrorism suspect. And this time, they've got a guy who is a Syrian refugee. And you know how that pushes buttons for Trump. He's the guy who issued the Muslim travel ban aimed primarily at those who've been displaced by America's wars of choice in the Middle East. And in the BuzzFeed account of this story about 21-year-old Mustafa Alowemer of Pittsburgh, it only takes four paragraphs to introduce the undercover FBI agent. And the quote is, the agent quoting Alowemer is saying, "We take revenge for our brothers in Nigeria." Now, he was born in Syria, came as a refugee in August of 2016, settled in Pittsburgh. And once again, here is a direct quote from the news item. He thought he was planning the attack with another ISIS supporter who was actually an undercover FBI agent. They communicated online and met four times in person, and Alowemer sent the agent bomb-making instructions and ISIS propaganda. Not in my name. Meanwhile, a couple of weeks ago, I shared with you some of the really disgusting online posts at Facebook, their tweets, their some are, you know, text messages from one police officer to another. And these were exposed by a group called the Plainview Project. And I'm pleased to see that there is a response. In Philadelphia, the police commissioner has pulled 72 cops from the streets, said some that would be fired. In Phoenix, the chief gave some officers non-patrol duty. In St. Louis, the top prosecutor said she would no longer accept cases from 22 officers. And these are examples. We had a case here in San Francisco a couple of years ago that went public where cops were tweeting and texting just disgusting racist messages and messages that show real contempt for the rights of individuals and the role of law enforcement. So I'm happy to see a little bit of movement in that direction. And look at this. The Supreme Court today issued a ruling. It is June, and they pop one almost every day. And the We Love Beer guy, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, wrote the opinion that I approve of, and it was a 7-2 majority. And this is a complicated case that involves the rights of an African-American man in Mississippi named Curtis Flowers. And a white prosecutor has tried him six times. And in each case, the results were overturned because the DA insisted on excluding all black jurors from the pool. And so Kavanaugh, who apparently has a history of caring about issues of jury selection and the racist implications of the use of peremptory objections to a particular juror candidate. I never thought I'd say something nice about Donald Trump and Brett Kavanaugh in the same day. Wow. Over in Istanbul, they announced that 151 people will be spending life in prison, and 128 of them will receive aggravated life, which indicates harsh conditions without parole. This is all related to the alleged coup attempt in the summer of 2016. And Erdogan has continued to consolidate power, expand his authoritarian rule, and there are more than 100,000 people who have been purged from jobs as teachers or, in the public sector. And all of this relates to his bender about Fethullah Gulen, this guy who's probably a CIA asset who's holed up in Pennsylvania, and Turkey keeps demanding his extradition. And I thought Trump was going to serve him up, but so far he hasn't. News from Guantanamo, where the shameful detention of 40 men continues. There is a new judge appointed to preside over the trial of the so-called 9/11 suspects. And he made a pretty good first impression. His name is W. Shane Cohen. He's a colonel in the Air Force. And he is the third judge to preside over this complex, slow-moving proceeding since 2012. And responding to questions from defense attorneys about whether he needs to be recused on certain issues, he was pretty open. He said, I do have some relatives who are Jewish, but I'm not. I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I believe that all people, men and women, should be able to worship how, where, and what they may. I have no affiliations with the State of Israel, nor do I harbor any ill will toward the religion of Islam. We also reported here a week or two ago about a hacking job that impacted a contractor for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. We were told that fewer than 100,000 photos of travelers crossing, I think at the San Diego border, had been compromised. But according to the Washington Post in a detailed report today, the assessment woefully underestimates the number of sensitive documents now freely available on the web, totaling hundreds of gigabytes. And it includes the technical details of license plate reader cameras that they've placed at the border, facial recognition cameras, and a lot of this is operated by a company that operates out of a strip mall near Nashville called Perceptix. And, documents included detailed records about Customs and Border Patrol contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars, revealing the exact names and cost quantities of hardware components at a number of ports, including the San Diego crossing at San Ysidro. Today I'm releasing to my subscribers an in-depth interview with my buddy Randy Hayes. Randy now lives in Washington, but he was based in San Francisco for many years, where he founded the Rainforest Action Network, and he has published a 7-point list, what he calls his New Green Deal. And he chose the words to contrast with the Green New Deal that's promoted by Senator Ed Markey and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And he's not dissing them or saying that they don't have worthy points in their plan. He is saying that we don't have time for an elegant transition. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Randy Hayes.
Well, the New Deal has a lot to do with, human prosperity. And we're all in favor of human prosperity. But that's not the entirety of the situation, because there is no vibrant economy. There's no social justice on a near-dead planet. So we've got to all put this into context of the planet's ability to support life, the life support systems of the planet, and that's the biosphere. So what we really need is not an anthropocentric or human-centered New Deal. We need a Green Deal. We need to look at nature's needs. We need to address nature's needs because, again, there's no vibrant economy on a near-dead planet. So I think we need a Green Deal, and the 7-point plan that I synthesized from a bunch of smart people that I get a chance to hang out with and learn from is much more aggressive and broader, and doesn't just focus on climate change. Climate change we refer to as the problem of the great problem of consequence that we have to resolve. But to me, it's not the biggest issue. It's not the biggest threat to the planet. There are about 9 life support systems in the biosphere. One of them is our global weather patterns, our climate. But there's the hydrologic cycle, the health of the oceans, and several other things. And they're all in trouble, frankly speaking.
That's Randy Hayes. I encourage you to listen to the full interview. It originally was posted at Who, What, Why a couple of weeks ago. And he has some really good comments that I hope you will listen and heed. Also, I want to thank listener Jerry Frescia, who lives in Italy. And he linked me up to an article I hadn't seen at Counterpunch, which details the threat of the permafrost melting. We mentioned the other day that it's melting at a rate that is 70 years ahead of the projections that were issued just a few years ago. And in this piece at Counterpunch, which is a little bit technical, we get a report from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And they are concerned that as the frozen subsea permafrost in shallow waters begins to melt, that there could be a burp. And this big burp would hugely accelerate the carbon that is in our atmosphere by a factor of at least 4. And again, you can read this technical stuff. You might understand it better than I do. But the bottom line is that there could be rapid acceleration that might occur in a very short period of time that could truly set us back and put us on a path to human extinction. And there is no vaccine that can prevent that. And I have kind of held back, hung back from the anti-vaxxer and vaccine zero-tolerance war that's underway. My bottom line is that I support vaccination, but I also support the right of a parent to decide what vaccinations their child receives. And I am pleased that Governor Newsom here in California intervened, and he negotiated changes to a bill that has now passed the Senate and voted out of committee yesterday in the Assembly here in California. And it would allow for limited exemptions. The bill, before it was amended, was going to require that any exemption had to be approved by the State Department of Public Health. And frankly, that's a little bit too much for my occasional libertarian leanings. I'm pleased to report, as a longtime union member, my union is SAG-AFTRA, that digital newsrooms are organizing at a record pace. Earlier this week, staff members at BuzzFeed did a walkout, but we've got union contracts now at Slate, Salon, Vice Media, Huffington Post, Vox, The Onion. What else would you recognize here? New York Magazines, The Cut, Vulture, and Intelligencer. And that is a trend that warms my heart. The New York Times earlier this week ran a lengthy feature on a man who the only good thing I can say about is that we're members of the same union. Michael Savage, whose real name is Michael Wiener, originates his Neanderthal right-wing radio show from just a couple of miles from where I'm seated right now, his rich neighborhood of Tiburon, California. And what's interesting about this piece, I've linked to it, and you can read it for yourself, is that Michael Savage, back in 2011, started featuring Donald Trump on his radio show. And he was a member of Mar-a-Lago. And for the first year or so of the Trump administration, Michael Savage was a valued friend of Trump. But now he is attacking Trump from the right, saying that he hasn't delivered on the border wall. And it's interesting because Savage's listeners are not going along with him. He sold them on Trump. They're still sold on Trump. And they've stopped following his lead. He said they keep pushing. Oh, this is a comment about the White House. They keep pushing me away because they don't like what in their mind is not 100% sycophantic behavior. And Ann Coulter weighs in. A lot of wingers are desperately hanging on to Trump as flotsam in a tsunami. So loads of Trumpsters are beside themselves, but almost none of them will say so publicly. I think the issue is how many voters who voted for Obama or didn't vote and then came out to vote for Trump are done with him. So that is amusing. And finally today, as I pack my bags and head off for a 3-week vacation, I'll note that members of Congress, particularly freshmen, are lining up for junkets to Israel. That is their summer vacation plan, And we got Steny Hoyer, number two guy in the House, who is nudging progressives to join the AIPAC tour. But you can also go with the slightly liberal Zionist team, the J Street team. And they actually conduct tours that are a little more detailed. They go to Ramallah in the West Bank. They have tried in the past to go to Gaza. And it's interesting to see. If you read the article that I've linked to from The Intercept, you'll find out if your member of Congress is going at all, is going with J Street, or is going with AIPAC. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. As I mentioned at the top, my next one will be on July 15th. I'll talk to you then. You're free to share this far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.